Cars today are built to last, but how they look is up to you, and that's where Maaco comes in. They specialize in cosmetic repairs. Let's say it's affordable paint jobs to fixing those annoying dents and dings. Whatever it is, Maaco has you covered. With more Americans keeping their cars longer, now's the time to protect your investment and keep it looking sharp for years. Get started. Visit your local Maaco today. Get the free estimate and see how easy it is to bring new life to your ride. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
Feeling overwhelmed by the state of politics? Finding it hard to get motivated? You might be suffering from erectile dysfunction, but Pod Save America has got the cure. Talk to your doctor about tuning into Pod Save America every Tuesday, Wednesday now, and Friday for a real talk conversation about the latest, biggest election of our lives and zero old guys yelling at you about the kids these days. Where else can you get that guarantee? Nowhere. Listen and subscribe to Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or watch on YouTube. Pod Save America is not approved by the FDA. Hello and welcome to the Bullard Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. We are here today with our man, Ben Wittes, on the Trump trials, on the SCOTUS craziness. He's the editor-in-chief of Lawfare, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He also writes Dog Shirt Daily. When we're finished with Ben, I'll be giving you an update on the state of play in the presidential race. Then we'll have Steve Shepard on to discuss what a brokered convention may or may not look like. Ben Wittes, a lot of news. How are you doing?
Yeah, a lot of news, and it's all bad. You think the debate sucks, so you say, well, there's going to be a French election, and then that sucks, and you're like, well, to heck with France, at least we're going to get a Supreme Court opinion, and then that's a disaster. You got to look at puppy videos at this point.
Yeah, puppy videos. Maybe some good news out of Britain. I tried to watch The Bear for a distraction last night. That is not a distraction. I just want to warn people. And so then I flipped over to Presumed Innocent. It's doing pretty good. That distracted me for about 30 minutes from the horrors. So my Twitter feed ranges from some legal experts who are saying that Joe Biden is now a king. We no longer have a constitutional democracy. And then some on the other side saying this is being way overinterpreted. Sends a lot of stuff back to the lower courts. So where do you fall in that spectrum?
Well, Joe Biden is a king. We no longer have a constitutional democracy is an excessive formulation of a true point, which is that there isn't any longer any ability to prosecute a president for criminal activity taken within his core constitutional responsibilities. And there may not be the ability to prosecute him at all for activity that is reasonably characterizable as within the outer limits of his responsibilities at all. Look, is it rhetorically excessive? Sure. But it's not wrong in the sense that yesterday morning, we assumed that a president who commits criminal activity in office is prosecutable for it. And today, we assume that a president who commits criminal acts in office has a very high degree of immunity, although the exact contours of it are still unspecified.
Yeah, so let's talk about those contours. Yeah, so they basically broke it down into three different types of acts.
Right. Although they didn't distinguish, and one of the just hair pulling aspects of this opinion is that it failed in the most basic responsibility of an appellate court, which is to give clear direction to the lower courts. I have read this thing carefully. I cannot distinguish what's in what basket. That said, there are three baskets leaking into one another, right? So one basket is the core irreducible functions of the presidency that are not regulable by Congress. So, for example, the pardon power, giving a State of the Union address, hiring and firing cabinet officers, right? These are things that are core presidential powers that the Congress can't really regulate. And so the Supreme Court says if Congress can't regulate them, it follows that the president must be immune from prosecution for acts of that nature. Now, whether that's right or wrong, the formulation of as immunity is controversial, but the basic proposition that you can't prosecute the president for doing things that the Constitution gives to him and only him is not especially controversial. And so I think if the court had stopped there, the opinion would have been, it would have had its critics, it would have been debated, but it wouldn't be especially controversial. It would have knocked some facts out of the indictment, particularly about the contemplation of firing the acting attorney general and replacing him with the environmental lawyer, but you wouldn't have had everybody's hair on fire.
Yeah. Okay. Before we get to the next act, though, I do want to drill in on one of those points, though, because you mentioned the pardon power. And, you know, several people I saw, including Mona Charon, my colleague, and others, pointing out the fact that, okay, well, if there's immunity for pardons, then essentially a president couldn't be prosecuted for being bribed for a pardon. Is that how you read this? Like, you could bribe presidents for pardons and have immunity?
Again, this gets to a different aspect of the opinion that is, I just think, wildly incorrect. So the court holds not merely that you are immune, you can't be charged with, you know, issuing an improper pardon, but that evidence of the immune act cannot be used against you in some other charge. And so that aspect of the immunity, which just seems to me wildly excessive, does seem to prevent a bribery prosecution for a, you know, a bribed pardon, a purchased pardon. You would be able to charge the bribery, but you couldn't use the fact of the pardon as the either the quid or the quo. And so, yeah, I think Mona is right about that. I don't think it's an inevitable consequence of saying that core presidential acts you can't be prosecuted for. It's a consequence of a second or third or fourth step that the court goes. So the second step is to say that there's this other immunity that covers all the other official acts that a president may take. They don't know if it's absolute yet, or they don't say. So, for example, a veto is a core presidential function. But, you know, giving a speech at a rally or consulting with Mike Pence about whether he should be hanged, hey, it's an official thing in some respect, but it's not necessarily core, irreducible presidential power. So they say there's a presumptive immunity there, but it can be overcome if you can show that prosecuting it would have no deleterious consequences for presidential power. So how robust an immunity that is unclear. That's my first hair-pulling criticism of the court. Why do you leave a question that important unclear, right? Your job is to give, you know, you haven't defined the boundaries between the core function and the non-core function. And then you haven't defined really when the non-core function is and isn't protected. So let me give you an example of the porousness of the boundary, which goes to one of the examples that hypotheticals that people keep throwing around. Droning your political opponents, calling out SEAL Team 6, right? On the one hand, you can say, well, wait a minute, that's a core presidential function, commander in chief of the military, totally core, right? On the other hand, you can say, well, wait a minute, Congress regulates the conduct of war, you know, Uniform Code of Military Justice, right? They have all kinds of functions in regulating the military. So it's not core, it's in this second basket. So I don't even know the answer to that, which basket that is. If Biden were to call out a drone strike on Donald Trump, Is that absolutely immune, or is it merely presumptively immune? I honestly don't know the answer to
that. And even if it's presumptively immune, there then are still a lot of limits on evidence gathering and all that, right? And isn't that the other element to this?
Right. Well, you would have to show for it not to be immune, but to overcome the presumption, you would have to show that the prosecution of it poses no risk to, you know, the legitimate exercise of executive authority. So the final basket is personal conduct, which is not immune. Now, we know this includes, for example, sexually harassing an Arkansas state worker before you were president. But what the line is while you're president between the personal and the official is completely unclear, and the court gives very, very little guidance about that.
Like stealing from a CVS feels like that's definitely a personal act, but, you know, stealing from the Treasury, maybe not.
Right. What about calling Brad Raffensperger and saying, hey, I just need 11,782 votes? Is that, as the Supreme Court seems to entertain, consulting with state officials about the integrity of an election, i.e. an official act? Or is that your conduct as a candidate trying to corruptly get a Secretary of State to change the outcome? I thought I knew the answer to that yesterday morning. I don't know the answer to that anymore. And by the way, neither does anybody else. And then finally, the court takes this additional step, which I think is really the most mind-boggling, which is that you can't use, it's not merely that you can't charge the conduct. You can't use the conduct as evidence of something else. So, you know, it'd be one thing to say, okay, you can't charge him for leaning on Mike Pence because that's somehow official, though I don't understand how, and it's presumptively immune. But you can use the evidence that he did that as evidence that there was some kind of corrupt slate of electors scheme going on. They say, no, you can't do that. You know, Amy Coney Barrett, who joins for much of the opinion, jumps off the bandwagon for that. So that's sort of an outline of what they did.
Okay. I want to go a little bit deeper on these Trump hypotheticals in a second, but first, I want to listen to President Biden's response in a 4-minute teleprompter address from the White House last night.
The outset of our nation, it was the character of George Washington, our first president, to define the presidency. He believed power was limited, not absolute. And that power always resides with the people, always. Now, over 200 years later, with today's Supreme Court decision, once again, it'll depend on the character of the men and women who hold that presidency that are going to define the limits of the power of the presidency, because the law will no longer do it. I know I will respect the limits of the presidential powers I have for 3.5 years, but any president, including Donald Trump, will now be free to ignore the law. I concur with Justice Sotomayor's dissent today. Here's what she said. She said, in every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. With fear for our democracy, I dissent. End of quote. So should the American people dissent. I dissent.
The president and Sonia Sotomayor obviously falling on the more alarmed side of the discussion here. But it seems to me that everything that he laid out there on substance is pretty reasonable.
Yeah. So again, as I say, the description of it as king is a little bit overheated in the sense that, you know, kings are hereditary, right? There are other features of monarchies.
Sure.
But the point is not wrong.
And being above the law.
Being above the law, knowing that you wield the entirety of the executive power of the United States, and you can't be prosecuted for violating the law. He's absolutely not wrong about that. Justice Sotomayor is not wrong about that. And I thought his statement last night was excellent. And I thought the subtle point that he made by saying, I know I will respect the limits of presidential authority, that that respect is now voluntary, you know, and that you're purely relying on character as the check, because the check is not that we'll fucking prosecute your ass after the fact. The check is not that we'll impeach you, because, by the way, the president will always have, you know, enough votes in the Senate to prevent impeachment from being meaningful, at least in this political environment. And so the check is your character. And I do think that's a good theme for him, you know, whether it overcomes other impediments with which you're more familiar than I don't know.
Well, good thing that we don't have the person with the worst character in the entire country as the leading candidate to be the next president, since character exactly. is the only check. Can we just do a 1 minute sidebar before we get back to the Trump trials? I just want to do a 1 minute sidebar with you.
Sure.
I agree with you. The substance of that, the president's statement was good last night. He has some new bronzer, it looks like. But that 4 minutes was the only time that he was public in the past 48 hours. My alarm, as people know, is extreme as a political matter, literally more than as like a functional matter of the government. So, you know, I'm just quizzing people. So on the scale from me, extremely panicked about the situation that we're in politically, to the Biden campaign, which says that he's vigorous and there's no problems here. Where do you fall on that scale?
I'm less temperamentally inclined to panic than you are, just as a you know matter of sort of baseline anxiety, I think. But This is true.
Me and my brother always say to other people when we're talking about our sports teams, it's like, you know, you have a good quarter and I'm like, we're winning the championship. And you have a bad quarter and I'm like, we need to trade everybody. So I do recognize that weakness in my temperament. That said, things are pretty bad.
You know, I didn't say it was a weakness in your temperament. It may be a weakness in mine, because sometimes the situation calls for panic. Look, my analysis of the situation is not different from yours. During the debate, I threaded or whatever. I don't know what the verb is for that.
Posted.
I bleated that Joe Biden needs to reflect on his performance in this debate and then do the right thing. I stand by that. I became convinced during that debate that he should not be the candidate. That is not up to me. As best as I can tell from the DNC's rules, it is entirely up to Joe Biden. If he chooses to proceed, I will support him and I will have, you know, the slogan, vote for the codger, it's important, or, you know, codgers, not criminals. Yeah, look, sure. He came out of that debate having had the mask pulled off, and I honestly have doubts about whether he can win, and I have doubts about his performance capability. And so, yeah, I'm worried about it, very, very worried about it. And the sequence of that debate happening and then the Supreme Court ruling is a very stark sequence that we cannot count on the criminal justice process to create accountability for Donald Trump, either retrospectively or, God forbid, prospectively. And we cannot count, I don't think, on Joe Biden to responsibly assess his own limitations as a candidate. And frankly, I don't pretend to understand how this all interacts with his capacity as president. I'm willing to believe that he's wise and fine in private settings, if that's what people who have been in those settings with him are saying. I don't really have an opinion about that. The fundamental duty is to win, because the capacity of the other side for evil is so magnificent. So yeah, I would say I agree with you, but in a more somewhat low-key way. I also don't have large numbers of people harassing me on Twitter about it.
I can take the harassment, because I agree with everything you said. So that was a dark and measured sidebar. And I mean, my request is also, I will be with Joe Biden. My request is simple, though. I would like for him to recognize that he's losing this campaign right now and to act accordingly. And being in hiding for 48 hours is not assuaging my concerns at all. It's exacerbating them.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Back to the Trump trials of this. Sarah Isger over at the Dispatch wrote this. The Trump people and the left's court haters are hot to trot on this being a complete victory for Trump. The delay is undoubtedly good for Trump, but as of now, it looks like all but one of the January 6th charges will probably move forward. What do you think about that?
I don't have any idea how she can purport to say that. I certainly hope she's correct. But under this opinion, Judge Chutkan, the district court judge in this case, needs to assess every allegation, perhaps fact by fact, for immunity. And first of all, she's going to have to hear from Trump's lawyers about each and every fact, each and every paragraph of that indictment. There are going to be, I agree with Sarah, a lot of them that are not plausibly official, but are personal. But there are going to be some of them that are in this muddy zone that are, you know, plausibly within the outer perimeter under as the court understands it. And those are going to have to, you're going to have a question about whether those can go forward. Then once you've done all that work at the district court level, which will take, you know, months, it's subject to immediate appeal before you go to trial. So, you know, you're going to have another trip up and down the appellate ladder. So at the end of the day, she may be right, but without knowing what five of the six justices in that majority think of, you know, which facts are private and which facts are official, she's kind of talking out of her ear. And so is everybody else who's pronouncing confidently about this.
Just to clarify, because you've already mentioned this, the 5 or 6, because Coney Barrett and the Coco Currents did speak specifically about the elector scheme and, you know, saying that she did not think that was included. Yeah.
Exactly. I think Coney Barrett has shown her hands about what's private and what's official in a way that the other five have not. The implications don't end with this case. People say, okay, the South Florida case is fine because it only involves post-presidential conduct. But remember, a bunch of the evidence of it involves the hoarding of those documents is presidential conduct and probably involves official acts that he will claim immunity for.
Yeah, the transfer to Florida, South Florida, right? I mean, like the literal transfer of the documents to Mar-a-Lago.
Yes, but also his packing of those boxes, yeah, his right. hoarding of that material, all took place while he was president.
Right.
Finally, the Georgia case is largely the same conduct as the federal case. That's all on hold, but we're going to have a very serious set of implications for that if the case ever unlocks. And then the New York case, there are isolated facts in it that took place while he was president, including a presidential tweet. He will surely go and try to have that case overturned. The New York Times says he already has, although I don't have independent confirmation of that. So I think it has broad implications for a bunch of those cases. And that's not to say the sky is falling. It could be that those implications are very manageable. Just based on the limited guidance in this opinion, we just don't know.
Okay. And so Trump then has obviously been bleeding. Just want to correct the record earlier. You don't bleat. Only Trump bleats. you send considered posts on threads.com.
Okay.
But he's been bleeding that this does kind of absolve him of New York. And obviously we're coming up, we have sentencing in 9 days. What's your sense on that?
I think his argument in the New York case is quite weak, and I don't see any reason to believe that Justice Merchan will accept it. I doubt that the appellate courts in New York will accept it. It affects a very limited amount of evidence, and so the evidence that he has can show prejudice as a result of this, I think, is minor. That said, you know, you could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court after this goes up the New York appellate ladder. And again, who knows how justices will think about that. So I would say it's a very outside chance, but it's not a zero possibility. I do think Justice Merchan is likely to proceed with the sentencing. And one technical point, none of it absolves him. So when you're immune from something, it doesn't mean you didn't commit a crime. If a diplomat from a foreign country murders somebody, they're guilty of murder. Our courts merely don't have the power to try them, right? And so I do think as a normative matter, when we describe this, we should always talk about the crimes he committed. The finding that he is immune is not a finding that he is innocent. It is a finding that, you know, the courts lack the power to adjudicate it. So just as a member of Congress who releases a whole bunch of classified information on the floor of the Senate, they still released classified information. They committed the crime. They have speech and debate immunity, right? I do not want to concede ever that if we have to drop a charge or two or three or all of them from the January 6th case, he's still a criminal.
That's a good point. Okay. I have one question about just kind of how outraged I should be about this court and their actions and just kind of the plain absurdity of a couple of their decisions. And then I know that rapid fire isn't really your cup of tea, Ben, but we do have a couple of questions from our Substack, from our Blog Plus subscribers. But these two comments from Chris Hayes and Mona Charon just really stood out to me. Chris wrote, grimly hilarious to compare the textual foundation for disqualifying Trump for insurrection right there in the 14th Amendment and the foundation for absolute criminal immunity for official acts, which is nowhere to be found in the Constitution, despite explicit grants of other forms of immunity. Mona adds, trying to absorb the Supreme Court immunity ruling, POTUS is immune from prosecution for all official acts, yet the Constitution itself says presidents can be impeached for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And it explicitly says the president can be impeached and prosecuted. That is the thing that is like the most outrageous about this, right? I mean, this is just on a strictly textual basis, like this has been an absurd run of rulings.
I completely agree. And it goes back a little further than that. It is very hard. And I say this as somebody who I am not a particular critic of conservative judging as a there are a bunch of judges on that court, conservative judges whose nominations I supported. I am not a hair on fire person about the courts. It is very hard to look at this string of rulings and not see that the textual fidelity of the court is directly dependent on who is the president. And I'm just not going to spend time trying to square the circle anymore. The Constitution says Donald Trump is disqualified from further office and trust, and it does not say that he is immune from prosecution. And the court finds the former point not to be in the Constitution, though you can read it, and the second point to be in the Constitution, though you can't.
Fucking outrageous. Okay, let's go to the Substack questions. First, can Congress change the law to establish limitations that the Supreme Court doesn't create? Is there anything that Congress, I mean, it's a Republican House right now, so, but hypothetically, is there anything that Congress could do to deal with this?
The answer is no. If there's a presidential immunity that's found in the Constitution, the president is immune and Congress cannot remove that immunity.
Related to that, then? And you mentioned earlier that the likelihood of a president getting impeached and convicted in this political environment like seems to be basically zero. But hypothetically speaking, if Congress impeached and convicted, does that open up prosecution for all acts covered by immunity?
Apparently not. And again, this is notwithstanding what the Constitution appears to say in the impeachment judgment clause, which is that I don't have the clause right in front of me, but that the president shall be liable post-conviction in impeachment to prosecution in the ordinary course of law, right? It's something that's very close to the language.
Yeah.
And notwithstanding that language, so Trump's argument was he can be prosecuted for anything that he was convicted of in impeachment. But the court's argument is, no, you can impeach him and remove him, and you can still prosecute him, but you can't prosecute him for the official acts subject to the caveats about that.
I just have to laugh just thinking about macabre laughter is the only thing that you can do in these situations. Just thinking about fucking Mitch McConnell, you know, talking about how he was not going to convict Trump
because the law
was going to take care of it. And now we have the conservative Supreme Court saying that the law can't take care of it. You know, it's just
you can't impeach him because he's out of office and the law should take care of it in criminal prosecution. And you can't prosecute him because of immunity, or at least there are serious limits on your ability to prosecute him.
It's just Calvin ball. Did you ever read Calvin and Hobbes? It's just Calvin ball all the way down. Calvin just gets to change the rules so that he wins no matter what happens.
But you're allowed to declare, you know, Hillary Clinton a criminal by pointing your finger at her, right? Lock her up.
Yeah. All right. Here's a couple more subset questions. Can King Biden do anything now to stave this off and help stop King Trump? There's some people that want you to give Biden some Machiavellian ideas.
Well, I mean, he basically announced last night that he wasn't going to do that. He said in the speech, I will respect the limits of the presidency. Some of us don't think that should be a voluntary thing. So the answer is he won't, nor would I urge the president to behave like a dictator. I would urge him to behave like a candidate.
Same. That's exactly where I am. And I continue to have nothing but respect for Joe Biden and the way that he's handled himself in the face of all these attacks on his family and extrajudicial efforts by his opponent. And by continuing to abide by the norms, it is admirable. But he also needs to take seriously the threat. And that reflects on his candidacy and the choice that's coming up. Okay. Why did the court feel like they had to rule on this so expansively when there's never been a problem of a president being pursued for official acts in the past?
I think that's a profound question. And the answer is completely unintelligible to me, which is one of the reasons that I did not see this opinion coming. Despite the oral argument, this opinion is kind of like if you take all the worst questions, the most suggestively bad questions that every justice asked, that's this opinion. And I really did not believe that was going to happen. The reason is exactly the rationale behind the question, that there was no reason to do this.
The last one, it's not the last one. We had many, many great questions from you. We have great Bulwark Plus subscribers, but I did my best to pick out ones that we could do quickly. But the self-pardon issue, which we've mentioned a couple of times on past episodes. But now this question is, if a future President Trump committed crimes that were clearly unofficial acts, couldn't he just self-pardon since pardons are official acts and nobody would have standing to bring up that challenge?
So look, I have always taken the view that the court would never tolerate a self-pardon. I will not say that today. And yes, the consequence of a self-pardon, it would be hard to review as a general matter. The only party withstanding to challenge it would be the Justice Department. In the next administration could try to bring a case, you plead the pardon, the Justice Department contends the pardon is invalid. The problem in this situation is that if Trump gets elected and he makes his case go away, and he would probably do it administratively, not by self-pardon, then the case is over. I think you should all just get used to the idea that if Trump gets elected, these cases are going away. By one means or another, they're going to disappear. But yeah, we have a question now. A lot of the underlying conduct can't be prosecuted, and some of it can. And there's an open question about whether the president can pardon himself for it.
Okay, I said that was the last question, but we have a little breaking news item here. The Manhattan DA's office said Tuesday it would not oppose Trump's request to file a motion arguing his conviction should be tossed, a move that will almost certainly delay Trump's sentencing. This guy's the luckiest son of a bitch in the world. I don't know if you have anything on that. But
so I'm not sure why it would delay his sentencing. Maybe it will. As I say, I don't think that motion is going to be particularly strong, so maybe it delays it by a couple of weeks or so, but I do think Trump is going to proceed to sentencing.
Ben Wittes, thank you. What a pleasant report that was from the hammock.
Yeah, isn't it? So tell me, is your world the political world, or my world the legal accountability world? Which is darker?
I think it's a really close call, and yeah, it's something that I'm gonna have to marinate on between now and our next get together before I can give
and
an official answer.
The merger of the two,
the merger,
you know, where they crash into each other, is really dark.
It's creating one of these horrible monsters, like from Transformers or He-Man or something, that combines like the two evil powers into one super monster.
Yep.
Anyway, Ben Wittes, thank you very much. Okay, up next, I'm gonna give a very brief update on the campaign side, and then we're going to have Steve Shepard. Stick around.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
All right, so we're going to get to Steve Shepard here. I want this to be an informational episode, you know, both about the court and about what a brokered convention could look like. Tomorrow, you know, we're going to get more into the implications, but just to lay the groundwork for why I think this is a worthwhile conversation to keep having. As I mentioned with Ben, I think there are legitimate questions about why Joe Biden has not been out more, why he's not taking any questions, he's not done a press conference, he's not done anything to assuage concerns about the debate besides teleprompter speeches. That is totally unusual. And so I think that leaves open questions about what's to come. I think another thing that leaves open questions is some big name Democrats are starting to speak out a little bit. Jamie Raskin did. Senator Peter Welch said he criticizes the campaign for the dismissive attitude towards people raising questions. Senator out of Vermont, Tim Ryan, former congressman and former Ohio Senate candidate, endorsed Kamala Harris. Then we have Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat out of Rhode Island, said that he wants reassurances after the debate that the president and his team are being candid with us about his condition, that this was a real anomaly, not just the way he is these days. That's a pretty serious comment. Another thing I've been hearing is that there haven't been a lot of private conversations between Joe Biden and leading Democrats, like you would think. Democratic House member Mike Quigley said Biden has to be honest with himself about whether he should be the party's nominee. And also, as we're taping this, we have breaking news. The first Democratic elected official to call for Joe Biden to drop out is a House member, Lloyd Doggett, out of Austin. He says that President Biden has continued to run substantially behind Democratic senators in key states, and he trails Donald Trump. I'd hoped the debate would provide some momentum to change it. It did not. Instead of reassuring voters, the president failed to effectively defend his many accomplishments and expose Trump's many lies. So Lloyd Doggett, the first Democrat to call for President Biden to drop. So these are elected Democrats are starting to speak out. And then as far as the polls are concerned, and there's a Pennsylvania poll yesterday that showed Biden losing to Trump by 4. On the same poll, Bob Casey, the Democratic senator, was winning by 4, an 8-point gap. In New Hampshire, a state President Biden won with 52% of the vote last time, poll showed him losing by 2 points, 44-42, a 10-point drop. And then I don't really love the Harvard-Harris poll because Mark Penn does it and he's a hack, but it has Trump up by 6. So that context, I think, reflects the fact that there remain very real concerns if we want to beat Donald Trump and deal with the threats that Ben Wittes just laid out, that there has to be a change of course, maybe with Joe Biden, maybe without Joe Biden. And so I want the next conversation to talk about what it would look like if there was a move to a different candidate. And with that, I'm here with Steve Shepard, an old friend, a fellow GW hoop super fan. It's been a rough decade for us. Senior campaigns and elections editor at Politico. Also, he's their chief polling analyst. We're not going to be talking Atlantic 10 basketball today, unfortunately, Steve.
Actually, that might be fortunate, given, like you said, the sad state of affairs over the last 8 years or so.
I mean, I don't know. The state of affairs for GW basketball has been bad, but is it as bad as the Biden campaign's state of affairs? I guess that's a close call these days. So I wanted to talk to you because, you know, these discussions, we've been having these discussions in the Bulwark. Okay, if Joe Biden can't do it, then what? You know, these if-then conversations. And some listeners, some people have wanted to hear like the practical, what this looks like, you know, rather than just sort of wish casting and fantasizing. So I wanted to talk to you about this because you've been covering conventions and delegates and politics, campaigns for Politico. And I think we're out with the first story about like what would happen if, like literally before the debate was even over, it felt like your story was out. So I figure you could get our folks up to speed. Does that sound good?
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And, you know, I think for a lot of folks, certainly was the case here in our newsroom. I'm in a back office here in the Politico newsroom, but we were all here last Thursday night, and about halfway through the debate when we had that first commercial break, that's when, you know, all of our editors gathered and sort of decided that, you know, people might be interested in what the mechanics are at this stage when all the primaries are over and all the delegates have been awarded and pledged. How does it work if the presumptive nominee didn't want to be the actual nominee?
Exactly. So I want us to just start with that, with the basics. So Jen Psaki was on and having a heated disagreement with my colleague Bill Kristol on This Week on Sunday, where her side of this case was that it would be very, very messy. And Bill was making the case that it was like, maybe not necessarily. I sort of lean towards the Bill side of that argument, but I wanted to play it out. So if we go through the basics here, we should just start with the first assumption is that this means that Joe Biden decides that he's going to back out and give his delegates up, right? Because there's not going to be like a challenge to Joe Biden on the floor, right?
No, keep in mind, Joe Biden won about 95% of the delegates during the Democratic primary season. Uncommitted got a few. You may recall Jason Palmer winning the caucuses in American Samoa. He got a couple. But Joe Biden, the vast, vast, vast majority of delegates are not only pledged to Joe Biden, but it's been the Biden campaign and the state parties who have selected the individuals who will actually serve as these delegates in the roll call vote. And, you know, a lot of times these folks are selected for their loyalty to the party and their loyalty, you know, in the case of the Biden campaign, to the president. So the idea that this could happen without President Biden agreeing to forego the nomination, it's pretty fanciful.
Who would have thought? Jason Palmer, potential power broker with his 8 delegates, whatever he has. All right. So let's say then that Joe Biden makes his choice of his own volition. Then the next question is it an open convention? Can he just pass the delegates over to Kamala? How would that work? Like, let's say they tried to do it clean. Could he just pass his delegates to Kamala? Or could he pass his delegates to another person?
Well, first, let's define the terms here. When I talk about delegates being pledged, there's this is a key distinction between the way Democrats do their convention and the way Republicans do theirs. On the Republican side, the delegates are not pledged, they're bound. And that means they're required to vote for the candidate to whom they're bound via the results of the primaries or caucuses in their state or their congressional district. And if they try to go rogue and vote for somebody else, the votes don't count. On the Democratic side, delegates are supposed to, according to the DNC's bylaws, are supposed to, in good conscience, follow the instructions of their pledging, but they're not required to. Again, the kind of mass revolt that Joe Biden, you know, dragged kicking and screaming, you would need a majority, roughly, of those delegates to vote against him. It's not going to happen. However, you know, these are folks, there is no instruction if the candidate to whom they're pledged is not placed in nomination.
So Joe Biden endorses somebody. It's like, that's Joe Biden's endorsement. I mean,
yes.
But maybe people could say, okay, I don't really, if you've dropped out, I don't care about that. Someone else throws their hat in the ring.
They could say that. However, again, these are people who've been selected for their party loyalty, for their loyalty to the president. And so you would need, of those roughly 3,900 delegates who have been pledged to Joe Biden, you would need about 1,900 to 2,000 of them to vote for a candidate other than, presumably, he would endorse Kamala Harris under basically any possibility he would endorse Kamala Harris. And so you would need a majority of them essentially to shun his endorsement and vote for someone else. And if you got that on the first ballot, then you would have what we would consider sort of a brokered convention. The subsequent ballots to try to identify a nominee, you would bring back, and we can talk about this a little bit, the superdelegates, folks who were around in 2016 and in years before will remember that concept. There have been some reforms to the DNC process since 2016 that has taken away these people's vote in the first round of balloting. But if no one wins a majority, they get to vote for whomever they want on the second ballot and could be potentially decisive if we ever got to that point.
And for folks who aren't getting a little gray hairs on their temples like you and me and don't remember the great superdelegate debate of 2016, remind folks who the superdelegates are.
So they're elected officials within the party, members of Congress, governors. They are members of the Democratic National Committee. They are former elected officials, former presidents, former vice presidents, former party leaders, former, you know, congressional leaders.
Luminaries. It's luminaries.
Yeah.
So if it goes to a second ballot, the luminaries, it becomes not just about the real American delegates, but it becomes the, you know, these superdelegates as well.
Right. And there are about 4,000 pledged delegates. And then there's another, there's no like publicized list of these people, but most estimates have it around 700 or 800 of these superdelegates. And so, you know, they alone can't decide the nominee, but they can certainly be decisive in a close vote if we ever got to that point.
So I'm with you. I think that kind of dealing with anything besides Joe Biden, I mean, Joe Biden leaving at all might be fanciful, but if you were to leave Joe Biden, doing anything besides endorsing Kamala seems far-fetched to me. But let's say that he doesn't. Let's say that Joe Biden says he's going to, you know, drop out of the race and that he thinks that, you know, there should be an open conversation among the delegates about who should replace him. Now, I've seen some reporting that in that case, Kamala still gets Joe Biden's operation, which would include the money, the staff. Is that right? And Kamala's the only person that could get access to that?
Yes. You know, the Federal Election Commission has pretty strict limits over how much money one candidate for federal office can give to another. So we had just today the Biden campaign assert, with the Democratic National Committee included, so this is an aggregate number, that DNC money would be available for any future candidate, no matter who it is. But there's a lot of money in Joe Biden's presidential campaign. There's a lot of money in his joint fundraising committee. That it's over $200 million as of the end of June, according to the campaign's announcement just shortly after the quarter ended. There are limits on how much one federal candidate can donate to another, but Kamala Harris is on the paperwork as the running mate and as the vice presidential candidate for the Biden campaign, and so she could get all of it. other candidates, the amount that you could transfer would be a very, 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 very tiny fraction of that. So they would essentially be starting from scratch unless they were an existing candidate for federal office that maybe had some money left over, like a Senate candidate who might have a few million in their account. Whoever it is would essentially be starting from scratch when it comes to those hard dollars that the candidates will use to largely on television advertising, which they can buy at a much cheaper rate than the outside spending. It would be very difficult for outside groups to sort of make up that difference because they pay 5-10 times more for the same TV ad that you might see on TV. If it's from a super PAC, they're paying a lot more to show that to you than if it's from a candidate themselves.
So this is the one area when I've been hearing feedback from people. It's like, Tim, we can't do this. The convention chaos is a problem. The ballot is a problem, maybe. I want to get to that next. The money is a problem. The money is the one area that I'm like a little, I'm not that concerned about that. I'm not impressed by that as a potential problem. And like I said, I think Kamala is likely the choice anyway. And so she would be able to have, you know, the entire war chest. But if somehow they came to a different type of candidate, and there would just be so much interest and so much excitement. I like the ability to raise money. And we've seen from Democratic candidates, you know, there'd be a week or two lag, but most of that week or two, there'd be wall-to-wall coverage about this insane, unprecedented thing happening that everybody would be seeing for free anyway. So I don't know. Am I, do you think I'm being a little Pollyanna about that?
No, I don't necessarily. I think it's so unprecedented that, you know, I'd hate to be the person in charge of the Act Blue servers if that ever came to pass, because, you know, we do know and have seen it since 2017, the fear that a lot of small dollar or online Democratic donors have when it comes to Donald Trump, both as president or as a presidential candidate, has been an extraordinary motivator for Democratic fundraising. That's been, you know, abundantly clear from January 20th, 2017 until now. We've never had this kind of scenario where everything would be sort of spun up right from scratch. And it, you know, it seems clear to me that even as there's been some fatigue among longstanding office holders and the money they're able to bring in now compared to what they were able to bring in say 2018 or 2019, the reality is that, you know, everyone, whoever gave on Act Blue would be coming to whoever this new person is, as long as it was someone who excited them and excited the party. I do think that's true. I think it would break a lot of records for fundraising in that moment. But also remember, the person would be starting from zero. And so you'd have to even remotely be competitive with the Trump campaign, which is actually doing a much better job of fundraising over the past couple of months than before, and seems to actually be able to raise money that doesn't go entirely to legal fees now.
I'm of the view that TV ads in presidential campaigns have pretty minimal impact compared to other races at this point. I mean, Joe Biden has outspent Donald Trump on the airwaves by lots and lots already to basically little effect, hopefully little effect, actually, because if it's been to significant effect, that means he's losing by even more without the ad advantage. So I want to get to the ballot part, but just really quick, going back to this convention chaos question. So if Joe Biden drops out, if he endorses Kamala, I assume it'll be pretty clean. But going back to your question, let's say other people throw their hat in the ring. I mean, have you had conversations about what that looks like? Like, could they, I don't know, like have a debate, have a forum? You know, do they go to these states and meet with the convention delegates? I mean, I guess you can't really do reporting on this because if it would leak if Gretchen Whitmer said she was already planning how she was going to go meet with the Texas delegates. But like, what do you imagine that could look like?
Well, I imagine it would take place under a very compressed timeline. We're all thinking about the convention as this thing in Chicago in late August, but the reality is the Democrats have said they're going to use a virtual roll call to choose their nominee very likely sometime this month in the back half of July. That roll call could be as early as Bloomberg's reported July 21st. I'd heard maybe something the week after instead, but we're talking about, you know, 3-4 weeks tops from now, and it would happen all virtually, which would kind of, for some Democrats worried about the like shades of 68 or, you know, convention floor chaos, either on the floor or outside the convention hall, to use the 1968 example. I'm not sure that would come to pass because theoretically, under this scenario, the nominee would be chosen in this virtual roll call, even if it got messy, even if it required multiple ballots. And then the convention the following month could still be this television show that is a, you know, big show of unity, the whole party coming together to the extent the Democratic Party can ever come together. That would still be the case. In terms of what the 3 to 4 week stretch would look like, you know, I think certainly you would see the veil lifted on what some of these other folks might be doing. Right now, I personally think what they're doing is mostly about positioning for 2028. You want to be seen as a good soldier for the party at when the party needs you most, showing up, not shoving the old guy out the door. And if the old guy decided he wanted to leave, you know, there you are in addition to that. So it kind of serves two purposes to me, probably 95% about 2028 and 5% about the break glass in case of emergency scenario.
Yeah, no, the Zoom roll call has been really lost in a lot of these conversations, as one of my favorite listeners keeps texting me, because especially in the Kamala scenario, like in theory, there could be a clean pass off, you know, where the delegates choose Kamala by essentially acclamation in this same Zoom, you know, convention roll call that they were planning on having anyway because of the ballots. And, you know, like you said, like that would eliminate all of the messiness. Now, that, who knows, right? Like, once you like open a Pandora's box like this, you know, somebody else might say, well, wait a minute, I want a challenge. And then how do you do a Zoom ballot, you know, where there's multiple candidates, right? Like, you know, it could also not, I think, is an important point here, particularly if it's the vice president.
Yeah. And the typical sort of like movement of candidates from hotel suite to woo the various state delegations that, you know, we've all read about. Certainly, you know, you and I are not old enough to
fear
have experienced
loathing
that.
The campaign trail.
Yeah,
I'm thinking back to, you know,
making of
days.
The president, 1972, yeah. You know, like all of that stuff, you know, that would take place via phone and Zoom, and it'd be very, very sort of 2020s era for sure.
Okay. So then let's talk about this, the ballot side of things. So the reason why they're doing the Zoom roll call is because of the Ohio state law, I guess, about when the candidates need to file by, which is before when the actual DNC convention is. The Democrats aren't going to win Ohio. So in some ways, this is kind of a meaningless point if they do have to extend it past. So my question is, what about these other states? There's been some discussion that Heritage is going to sue and thinks that they might have standing in, I think it was Nevada and Wisconsin, maybe one other of the swing states that might actually matter. What's your sense for the ballot side of things?
Well, look, I think that's also one reason why sort of time is of the essence, because, you know, we have like in-person early voting starting in a lot of these places in early to mid-September, which seems sort of crazy early, especially if there is a new candidate who needs to introduce themselves to the broader electorate. I think this is something I'm sure that the Democratic Party has many lawyers who will make sure that before they were to ever approach this scenario, that they would have all the boxes checked in all the states that matter. You know, Ohio, you mentioned, yes, Joe Biden or whoever the Democratic nominee is likely to be is not going to win Ohio. However, you know, Democrats very much need Sherrod Brown to win his Senate race.
You do worry about tamped down enthusiasm, I guess, if you're not on the ballot in Ohio.
Yeah, and then there's Marcy Kaptur, Amelia yeah. Sykes.
That's a fair point.
Greg Landsman, you know, some of the competitive congressional races. And they want to keep Republicans from sort of that filibuster-proof majority, supermajority in the state legislature. So, you know, there's more to worry about there. Look, I think if this were to ever come to happen short of, you know, an incapacitation scenario, I'm pretty sure they would have all the legal boxes checked before they tried it.
All right. Last question is on the vice president side of this, because I haven't seen a lot of discussion about that. So yeah. Let's say the clean option happens and Joe Biden, you know, clean. we're in really strange times, relatively clean given the situation, where Joe Biden chooses to leave the race, endorses Kamala Harris. She wins on the first ballot. Can she then pick her vice president, or are we in a 1972 situation where multiple people put their hat in the ring and the delegates pick the vice president?
Ultimately, the delegates pick the nominee. The delegates pick everybody. Obviously, you know, in modern times, the delegates have deferred to the nominee's choice of running mate. You know, there's a couple different scenarios here. Does Kamala Harris keep nearly all of the Biden delegates because they're loyal and, you know, they go along with whomever she wants to choose? Probably, you know, somebody among the group of folks that we're talking about in this sort of shadow primary. Or, you know, is it a closer race? Is it, you know, she's only getting between 50 and 60% of the delegates, and some of those delegates would seek as negotiating tactic or negotiating position, a specific running mate that, maybe you could grab the Michigan delegation by promising to choose Gretchen Whitmer as your running mate, or maybe you could grab the Kentucky delegation by promising to choose Andy Beshear. The one person it would kind of take off the table would be Gavin Newsom, because of course then a Harris-Newsom ticket would make Democrats ineligible to win the 54 electoral votes from California, and there's just very little way to make up that kind of math when it comes to the Electoral College majority. So, I think that that could be some place where the delegates were to have some sway. Ultimately, unless it's a super, super contested convention for the actual presidential nominee, it's difficult to imagine a wide open race where the delegates are choosing and ignoring whoever the presidential nominee's preferred running mate is and just choosing someone on their own.
Well, I like that Beshear idea. I'm having lots of conversations with Democrats. Any Democrat that'll talk to me, I accept their phone calls these days. Somebody suggested a little Roy Cooper. We could use somebody with a Southern accent, a good old boy on the ticket. I don't know. Maybe the North Carolina delegation could help us with that. Anyway, Steve Shepard, this has been super helpful. Thank you for the briefing. Keep up the good work over there. We'll talk to you soon, brother. Raise high.
You got it, Tim. Good to see you.
All right. Thanks to Steve Shepard. Thank you to Ben Wittes. It was a pretty depressing show. I don't know that tomorrow's going to be a ton better, but there will at least be some laughs, because I'll have your friend and mine, Crooked Media's John Lovett. One problem, despite the fact that John was recently on Survivor, he still needs his beauty rest. So show might be out a little bit later in the afternoon. That's all right. It's a long weekend. And so stick around, refresh your little podcast app. You'll see me and John tomorrow late afternoon. Peace.
It's good to be king, if just for a while, to be there in velvet. Yeah, to give them a smile. It's good to get high and never come down. It's good to be king of your own little town. Yeah, the world would swing. Your own way, get a feeling of peace at the end of the day. When you build dark barns and your canary sings, you're out there with winners. It's good to be king. Yeah.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper, with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.